I'm Larry Mohn, president of the Manhattan Institute, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you all to our first annual F.A. Hayek Lecture. This event was the inspiration of one of the Institute's trustees, Tom Smith. Tom encouraged us to return to our roots by organizing an annual event that would publicly celebrate Hayek, our intellectual progenitor. And not only Hayek, but also those who have followed in his footsteps by promoting economic and individual liberty. Why Hayek? Hayek, of course, is the most influential proponent of the free market system in modern history, but to limit his work to economics is to do him a great disservice. Hayek understood that markets don't work in a moral vacuum. He understood that markets and morality are not just related, but in fact are inseparable. Hayek also understood the importance of ideas. Following the success of The Road to Serfdom, he penned a 1949 essay, The Intellectuals and Socialism. In it, he argued that the seemingly inevitable world movement towards collectivism was not inevitable at all. Rather, it was the result of bad ideas among the intellectual class. Around the same time, a decorated RAF gunner, Anthony Fisher, visited Hayek at the London School of Economics. Fisher had come back from World War II. He was haunted by the devastation that totalitarianism had wrought, and he was fearful of the political and intellectual direction in which Britain and the rest of the West seemed to be headed. He had decided to try and effect change by running for office. Hayek, however, dissuaded Fisher from this course. He explained that politicians are what we today call lagging indicators. It is the intellectuals who ultimately determine the ideas of politicians in the course of events. The real task was to change those ideas. Instead of running for office, Hayek encouraged Fisher to start a scholarly research organization that would focus on promoting the classically liberal theories of limited government and the rule of law, and would be immune from the pressures and the deal-making associated with everyday politics. Hayek also explained the importance of involving business leaders. He believed that businessmen too often fail to understand the relationship between ideas and the subsequent political decisions. As a result, they had never mounted a sustained intellectual defense of their own interests. Fortunately, Anthony Fisher had established a successful chicken farming business and had the financial wherewithal to implement Hayek's vision. He soon became the Johnny Appleseed of free market think tanks, funding the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, which has had enormous influence on public policy and the views of leading politicians, most notably Margaret Thatcher, and as well as the Atlas Foundation, which spreads the free market message through its network of think tanks across the globe. Then Fisher, who was inspired by the idea of starting free market think tanks around the world, came to New York, the capital of capitalism, which, like much of America, had seemingly lost its way in the 1970s. In New York, he came in contact with a group of businessmen, people like Chuck Bruni, Lou Lehrman, Bill Casey. They were concerned about the direction the country and the city were taking. They decided to engage in a battle of ideas. With help from an emerging group of foundations, they founded the International Center for Economic Policy Studies, which soon morphed into the Manhattan Institute. The rest, as they say, is history. So that is why we honor F.A. Hayek in this lecture series. And on behalf of the Manhattan Institute, let me just say that it is an honor to have Michael Novak deliver the inaugural lecture. In recent years, no one has done more than Michael to demonstrate that a free society is not just practical, but moral as well. And now for a more formal introduction of Michael Novak, I'm delighted to turn to his good friend and colleague, Father Richard John Newhouse. As you know, Father Newhouse is the founder of the Institute for Religion and Public Life and editor-in-chief of its wonderful journal, First Things. Along with Michael Novak and George Weigel, he's also part of the neoconservative troika that has done so much to harmonize Hayek's free market teachings with the Catholic Church's social concern. Their work has had an enormous impact, particularly behind the Iron Curtain, and deeply influenced the late Pope John Paul's thinking and writing on the subject of democratic capitalism. Besides editing First Things, Father Newhouse also serves on the boards of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and the Foundation for Community and Faith-Based Enterprises. In a survey of national leadership, U.S. News and World Report named Father Newhouse one of the 32 most influential intellectuals in America. Please join me in welcoming Father John Newhouse.
Thank you, Larry, for that generous introduction. To be part of an event honoring Friedrich Hayek and Michael Novak is indeed to be honored. Michael has been a friend for 30-plus years, immeasurably enriching my mind and my life. Hayek wrote a famous essay. Most of you well know this. He wrote an essay, Why I Am Not a Conservative. And Michael is very much in that stream of thought. He calls himself a Whig, claiming that St. Thomas Aquinas was the first Whig. He has not persuaded all Thomists of this, but he's had a lifelong habit, Michael Novak has, and an extraordinary skill of stealing the best cards from the liberal deck. In 1982, he published, 23 years ago now, The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. One hesitates to say of any book that it changed a way of framing a question forever, but if you can say it of any book, or even of a few books, you would have to include The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. It was not an uncritical celebration of capitalism, and certainly not limited to the economic sphere, but as Larry points out, it is very much a cultural and a moral and a spiritual and a theological argument in which Michael Novak very persuasively turned around the conventional understandings of what is meant by idealism and what is meant by realism, and made the case that realism about God-given human nature and human nature's propensity for and ability to creatively exploit freedom results in greater justice, greater social justice. Disagreed with Hayek, I think, on whether social justice is a term that ought to be admitted to the discussion. Michael made the case that those concerned for justice, and especially for the poor and the marginal, should take another look, and more than another look, at the market economy. Before Michael Novak, it is safe to say that not only in the intellectual world generally, but among moral philosophers and theologians particularly, capitalism was radically criticized for its evil intention, while socialism, if it was criticized at all, was criticized for the failures to achieve its good intentions. Michael, at least in the worlds of moral philosophy and theology, changed that discussion more than any other one person. He knows, of course, that the battle is not won, and he knows that being a champion of capitalism with a good conscience necessarily entails sharp criticism of capitalists who fail to do what the possibilities of the enterprise make it possible to do. And so he has been a critic of both the, if you will, sins of commission and sins of omission within the free market. But always, Michael Novak, over all these years I've known him, has been marked by a patience in making an argument again and again, a patience that, frankly, I envy. I've seen Michael in a thousand different circumstances begin with the most obdurate, ignorant, prejudiced interlocutor in the world and sit down as though he had nothing better to do with his life than to begin at square one and go over the argument again and again. Patience, persistence, hopefulness. These are the marks of the thought of Michael Novak. These are his virtues, and they are virtues that will be tested, no doubt, as he tries to persuade the world that there is a more promising future with respect to Islam and democracy. Not an easy argument to make, but if anybody is going to make it, I can't imagine somebody better equipped from our company than my dear friend, Michael Novak.
That was really a beautiful introduction and a great mark of friendship for which I'm deeply appreciative. However, I do have to comment that after all these years, about my humility, he still has nothing to say. It is fitting that the first annual Friedrich Hayek lecture at the Manhattan Institute should focus on the subject, Islam Tests Democracy. Since one of Hayek's greatest books on his most significant underlying theme was the Constitution of Liberty. Following Lord Acton, Hayek in the epilogue of that book described himself as neither a conservative, which in those days meant practically landed gentry or Tory, nor a progressive, which in those days meant socialist or worse, but rather as a Whig. For Hayek, leaning on Acton, Whig meant the Party of Liberty, whose core concept, he noted, going back to Thomas Aquinas, is the beauty and dignity of the liberty of the human person. Aquinas had written that the human person is the most beautiful thing in the universe, the most beautiful of God's creatures.